Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This is Dan Nexon. In this podcast, I'll be conversing with Megan Spooner, who is a young adult fantasy and science fiction writer living in Northern Virginia. Her debut novel, which is also the focus of our discussion, is called Skylark. She is also the co-author of the upcoming young adult science fiction novel, These Broken Stars, which will be published by Disney Hyperion in 2013. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and today we're talking to Meg Spooner. Meg, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you start out by telling us a bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a writer living in Northern Virginia. My first book is a young adult fantasy called Skylark, and it just came out a couple weeks ago. And I guess I've wanted to be a writer ever since I was very young, since I was 4 years old, actually. But until I got the idea for Skylark, I never even finished an entire novel because I get very easily distracted by new ideas. And it wasn't until I found one gripping enough for me that I actually realized that I wanted to see it through.
So I think hopefully we'll come back a little bit to how your more sort of detailed biographical factors might have influenced the book. But maybe you should tell us a little bit about the world of Skylark. It's a fairly unusual dystopia. What are the key things that our listeners should know about it?
Well, the city that Lark grows up in does share a lot of commonalities with more traditional dystopian settings. Her world is all about fitting in and being adequate. Not brilliant, not extraordinary, but just, you know, good enough. And in her world, all any child wants is to become an adult and be a fully functioning, useful member of society, because that is the pinnacle of existence there. And in creating this world, I chose to have an actual literal rite of passage for children, where they have their magic, which is referred to by the city rather unromantically as the resource. They have that magic harvested and used to power the city. And the metaphor there was not accidental, the metaphor for the loss of innocence that a child experiences as they cross into adulthood. But I think that what makes the world of Skylark different from some of the other dystopias that you might look at is that outside of the city, beyond this wall that closes them in, is a world bursting with magic. There's everything is out there waiting to be discovered. So while the setup is that someone grows up and loses that innocence, loses the magic and that sense of discovery, the beautiful, I guess, or hopeful thing is that it can be regained and it can be found again.
So just to, let's get very mundane here for a second, although I guess mundane is the wrong world to talk about, wrong word to talk about a well-realized SF fantasy setting. So Lark is your main character, and she's, how old is she?
She is 16.
And she lives in a place that's just referred to as the city, is that correct?
Yes.
And that city is powered, as you say, by magic, or the resource,
right.
And it is cut off from the rest of the world. Now, what's happened to the rest of the world that's required the city to be hermetically sealed?
Well, one of the fun things about writing science fiction and fantasy is that you can go off on these thought experiments where you can create whole worlds and whole histories that never actually show up in the manuscript. And one of the things that happened to me with Skylark is that I actually came up with this former world before Lark's world, long before I ever came up with the city. The background is that instead of electricity, this world's technology is powered by magic. And in a way, it's a parallel world to our own. And so a lot of the history is the same, but slightly different. And in Lark's world, around this time, around modern times, magic began to be overused by its population, exploited, you know, its resources exploited. And wars broke out because, you know, the resource was dwindling and, you know, people want power. The nature of humanity is that people want power. And the wars led to cataclysmic events that wiped out society. And the city came about because scientists in that world knew what was happening, and they set up this experimental city to sort of hide away from the wars. Instead of participating, they chose to hide. And they put up this wall that shielded it from the magical fallout from these wars. And now, 100 years later, as far as they know, they're all that's left.
So in a sense, what you have here is a magical world's version of an experiment in a steady state society. Mm-hmm. And with that comes some of the authoritarianism and the repression that we associate with closely controlled societies. How does that manifest in the city?
Can you say the question again?
Sure, I may have gotten too much into the, you know, the sort of social science speak. So
no, it's cool.
it's interesting. I hadn't really picked up when I read the novel that this was an experimental city, right? I'd sort of seen it as a last-ditch attempt to protect humanity by a group of scientists.
It definitely is that as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were several last-ditch efforts across the continent. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, go on. I'm sorry.
And this is just the one that we happen to be focusing on, because it's the one where our character lives.
And as you call them, natural philosophers. And mm-hmm. so they set up this society or this small city that's designed to maximally conserve the resource and allow humanity to persist. But over time, they become kind of an aristocratic or oligarchic class that tightly controls the activities of the inhabitants of the city. And part of that is because they, you know, obviously comes out of an impulse to conserve resources. But there's a real sense that it's also become corrupted over time. So mm-hmm. I was curious about kind of the politics of the city, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the basis of it comes from the old saying that power corrupts. And in Skylark, it's both metaphorical power and literal power. The Institute, which is the word basically for the government, that started out as being full of scientists or architects, as they're called in the book, but is now basically just the ruling body of the city. They have the power in the sense that they rule the city, but they also have the power in the sense of magical power. They strip it from the citizenry as they become adults and use it for their own purposes. Of course, their purposes are, in theory, noble. They're protecting society. They're keeping the wall up. They're keeping out all of the potentially deadly things that lie beyond the wall. But there is a question of, at what point do the ends stop justifying the means? I dislike villains who are villainous for villainy's sake. I always like people who have good intentions and evil that is a matter of degrees. I like choices that are potentially the wrong choices, potentially the bad choices, but choices.
And that's an impulse, I think, that comes across really clearly and very effectively in the book. Lark is very self-reflective about the difficulty of choices. And so in a sense, there are moments, I think, that you do really well when it's clear that there is no good choice for her. Somebody has to get hurt, even though she sees very, I think she sees, and she's very explicit, that most of the people who are being pitted against one another, none of them are evil or necessarily mm-hmm. deserving of their fate. So I thought that was something that you did very effectively. I know it's an important kind of theme to work through, particularly in young adult fiction.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned on your website and a couple other places that I've looked at that Skylark started out set in a post-apocalyptic Washington, D.C., and it struck me as we follow, and I don't think this would give too much away, you know, that Lark eventually leaves the city
right.
and has to go out into the wasteland. It felt like she was traveling through, out of the core of D.C., maybe out of the National Mall, across the bridge, into an area that looked like it could be Northern Virginia. Was that deliberate? Did you retain elements of that geography?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. You can tell that you're a D.C. native because you recognized the mall. But yeah, except for 4 years of college in New York and a couple of years living overseas in Australia, I've lived my whole life right outside Washington, D.C. And as soon as I realized that I wanted the totalitarian government of Lark City to be all about knowledge and originally about science, I knew that I wanted it to correlate with the Smithsonian Institute in D.C. But where our Smithsonian is all about discovery and the sharing of human knowledge, and in Lark's world, it's the opposite. Her institute is holding all history and science in trust, so to speak, protecting it, keeping it away from its citizens on the pretense that society is still recovering from the wars and isn't ready for this kind of knowledge. So, yeah, the city is D.C., the wilderness that Lark finds herself in at the start of Act Two is Northern Virginia. The suburbs that she encounters, the parks, eventually the mountains, the Shenandoahs, and many of the places she travels to are based on real places I've been, but often just changed slightly to reflect the parallel nature of her world to ours.
So I'd like to hear more about the main character, whose name, as we've mentioned, is Lark. How did you come up with her? How do you imagine her?
Well, like many dystopian heroes and heroines, Lark doesn't start out thinking that there's anything wrong with her world. She's, you know, her greatest aspiration is just to fit in this society. But as you learn through the beginning of the book, that's not possible for her. And so eventually she chooses freedom over enslavement. And as we've said, she flees beyond the wall and goes into the wilderness. And all of that starts to change. And I wanted her to feel like a normal teenage girl. I love strong heroines, but I don't think that strength is entirely in your muscles or in your magic. Lark's strength, at the risk of sounding utterly cheesy, Lark's strength is strength of character. She is woefully unprepared for what waits for her on the other side of the wall, but she goes anyway. She's never seen the sky, only the inside of her city's dome. So when she finally does see it, she's afraid of it. She's got aranophobia to the point of breakdown. She has all these fears and inadequacies that she has to battle almost entirely on her own, which for me was a challenge to write, because the temptation is to just make her instantly strong and awesome, because strong characters are inherently likable. But I wanted Lark's strength to be a gradual thing. She learns, she adapts, she gets smarter, she learns how to survive. She becomes a force in her own right, and I think that that makes her eventual independence and strength that much more satisfying.
So did you have any sources, literary, real world, people you modeled her after, or what have you, in mind when you developed her?
Well, there are a million examples of strong heroines that come to mind, like Buffy from Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Ripley from the Alien franchise, but I don't think that there are as many examples of quieter strength, probably because they're quieter. So I didn't really base that part of Lark on anything. A lot of authors, I think, create their stories and characters while thinking about what their audience would want. But I have to admit that my audience is basically myself. I write the things that I would like to read, the things that I would have gobbled up when I was a teenager. I think that the teen experience is universal enough that the things that fascinated me as a teenager are the same things that are going to fascinate other teens. And to be honest, things that still hang me up today. Identity is a big issue for me and for other people. I'm in my 20s now, and it's still an issue for me. And I think many people are still trying to figure out who they are well into their 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, for the rest of their lives. Everyone continues to change. So I think that journeys of discovery, stories that focus on a character's process of becoming who they're meant to be, those will always be universal.
So I found it particularly interesting how you put a new twist on a lot of the staples of post-apocalyptic and young adult genre work. And you've already mentioned in some detail how magic becomes a kind of stand-in for all sorts of resource consumption, and in that this is a world that has fallen apart because its humanity has eroded the carrying capacity provided by magic. Mm-hmm. Magic also serves some other interesting you know, allegorical or metaphorical uses as kind of the life force writ large that people have. And, you know, I don't think, again, it's giving away too much that when she goes out into this wasteland and discovers a world in which magic has really been depleted, that world is twisted and frightening and barren in the way that you would normally see associated with, say, 50s or 60s era post-apocalyptic yeah. nuclear war fantasy, right? Where instead of radiation, you even use the term fallout. It's the yeah. absence of magic that twists the world and renders it lifeless in a lot of places. Are there other kinds of staples that you were deliberately playing with, or other things that we should be aware of that had this kind of interesting spin on them that we would see otherwise, you know, that draw on elements from the genres you're playing with?
Yeah, other themes. It's funny, when I'm writing, I never think about themes. I'm just telling a story. The themes tend to come out after the fact, and usually they're pinpointed by other people. My critique partner, my agent, my editor, they're constantly going, "I love how you incorporated the X theme here." And I'm like, "Really?" I had no idea. But I think that actually happens to writers a lot. So other themes, I think violence is definitely something that I look at in Skylark, because there are aspects of horror in here as well. And Lark's home city is utterly lacking in violence. Even the worst possible punishment, which is referred to as adjustment, is simply a voluntary departure from the city. It's a very bloodless and dispassionate ceremony. But once she crosses the wall, everything is life or death, kill or be killed, which is actually something that comes up, a point of contention between Lark and one of the other characters, Orin, who is a wild boy that she meets in the wilderness. So while the world beyond the wall is violent and brutal, and there's no question about that, there's also beauty to be found there that could never exist in the colorless environment within the wall, which is not to say that violence is beautiful. I don't want to romanticize pain or brutality, but it's the whole idea that you can't have the good without the bad. And this really connects with one of my favorite books of all time, which is The Giver by Lois Lowry. I love that book. I read it probably twice a year, and every time I read it, I get something new from it. But the main character in that book faces a choice between a life without pain, without grief, without suffering of any kind, but it's also a life without color, without art, without music. It's a life without love. And the point is that to have those things, you have to have the suffering too. And I think that that's something that is definitely present in Skylark.
It's interesting, as a political scientist, I had read the argument, it's principally one in which the city's attitude is sort of Hobbesian, right? That if you want to, that because the state of nature or the world outside the wall is so harsh, the only option is a kind of, is an authoritarian sovereignty, right? Absolute sovereignty. And that one of the things that Lark is doing as she leaves the community, discovers other communities, meets other people, other perspectives that, you know, is looking, you know, that is a kind of search for an alternative, right? But I guess one of the things about strong literature, whether it's in the young adult or the literary fiction mode, which I have air quotes around, is that it has, you know, multiple readings in ways that it can speak to audiences with the, you know, yeah. different audiences with the same sort of things. You mentioned that this is a fairly violent world out there, and you really don't pull any punches when it comes to showing just how dark and twisted the world outside, well, not only the world outside the wall, but the world within the wall. I love the particular way that you have these pockets of magic that she encounters. And when you go into them, there are these, they really kind of create all at the same time the sense of beauty, but also sadness and often danger. And there's something, if you'll excuse me, magical about that. And it gets at a lot of the, you know, sort of what we think of when we think about magic. But I'm curious where some of those images came from, these moments that have all of these kind of mixed emotions and mixed thematics and mixed, you know, I don't know what the term I'm looking for, but have the sense of that they can be both beautiful and sad and dangerous at the same time, where those images came from.
Well, I think that the magical pockets, I really wanted to give glimpses of what a world with magic looked like, because as you were saying, the world beyond the wall is this barren wasteland, twisted by the depletion of magic. And I wanted Lark to have glimpses of what a world with magic would look like. You know, what it might have been like before, but more importantly, what it might be like again. And this is actually one of those things I don't expect every reader to pick up on. There's a lot of things that you put into your books that are there in the background, but not necessarily meant to be seen or digested consciously. Of course, there's a lot that you don't put in that people get out of it anyway. But I think that's the beautiful thing about storytelling, is that while no two people can tell the same story the same way, it's also true that no two people can hear the same story the same way. But back to the pockets, the linking factor between the pockets of magic is time, actually. In one of the pockets, time has sped up dramatically so that Lark enters a world in which nature has reclaimed the ruins she's walking through. The trees have taken over. In another pocket, time has been all but suspended, to the point where there's almost an echo, an imprint or memory of the last days of the family that lived there, replaying over and over in an endless loop. In another pocket, it's always summer. It's the summer lake. And I love time, and you know, don't be surprised if someday I write a time travel series, but I love time as a vehicle for storytelling. And that's really where the pockets came from. They're all reflections of time and what time does to the world.
And of course, the city itself is a pocket whose time operates in rather different rhythms than any of the other timescapes that Lark goes through. That's really cool. I actually had not picked up on that, but now I see it very clearly.
Yeah, and the city, there's a lot of references to clockwork, because the machinery that operates on magic is clockwork, but there's also a sense of everything ordered, everything in its time, everything, you know, ticking over every second, doing everything exactly as it should be, breaking time down into these bite-sized, manageable pieces. And then when Lark goes out into the world and finds these pockets of magic, time has just exploded.
One of the other kind of, you know, I asked you earlier, and I think I asked you in such a long-winded way that it threw you, but I asked you about, you know, other ways that you were kind of putting a unique spin on tropes that appear in the various genres you're working with. And one of the really, the cool images we have here that really begin, you know, we get at the very beginning is are these pixies, right? These mechanical, these mechanical flying clockwork entities that are the eyes and ears of the city, and which run off of, you know, little crystals of magic. And again, I hope we're not giving too much away, but one of those pixies winds up traveling as a kind of ambiguous companion with Lark. That's such a striking image, right? The pixies and the pixie is a kind of mechanical and yet magical entity. Was that something that you kind of started with, that developed as you went along with the story?
Yeah, the pixies were something that I came up with very early as just a cool thing that I thought of and wanted to use. And I didn't really have a good place to put them, so they were kind of floating around in the back of my mind as I started writing. And it was shortly after Lark left the city and went out into the wilderness that I realized I had a problem because I had set up this story in which my character was going to be alone for pretty much the entire story. And I did not want to have, I wanted her to be able to speak. I wanted her dialogue to be external as well as internal. And so I knew I needed to give her a companion. And because the character of Lark is really all about morality and choice and making decisions and, you know, black and white and the gradations of gray in between, I thought that the perfect foil for her would be a machine that has no morality. Its only morality, if you want to call it that, is its programming. And what makes it unique is that it has been programmed to learn. And so it begins to develop, perhaps, its own morality. And that was, it's funny because I put Nyx, which is the name of this pixie, I put Nyx in there as a last-ditch effort to give Lark someone to talk to, and it ended up becoming one of my favorite characters because it's the perfect way to have Lark talk through all of her choices. It makes for the perfect foil for her. And I do like the combination of machinery and magic. Magic as this sort of wild by nature force, untamable raw energy being twisted and pinned to these little machines and forced to do the city's bidding. I really liked that tension.
What also gives her a familiar, right? In the old.
Yeah. Nyx is her animal companion, mm-hmm. but he's not an animal and at times not even a very good companion.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, as I've tried to prep more and more for getting back into science fiction and fantasy, I've been reading an increasing amount of writing about producing fantasy. And one of the things, of course, that you have in a genre that's become increasingly mature is that there is a lot of writing about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I keep on seeing is the notion that what magic has become in fantasy is essentially an energy source, right? Mm-hmm. That human beings can draw on. Right. And you've made that very literal in this particular novel. But I wonder in some ways whether that view of magic and the view of magic that you have here, and this isn't a criticism, it's more of a kind of opportunity. I want to kind of get your views on this. It's a very hyper-rationalized way of thinking about magic, right? Mm-hmm. And is almost the antithesis of magic as a kind of as a force of enchantment and a force of kind of inner rational, other human, incomprehensible form of power, the way that a lot of the romance literature and folkloric mm-hmm. sources that fantasy builds upon would have conceptualized it. Do you think that we're losing anything when we think about magic in that way, or is there a way that in particular you want to kind of draw on different elements of the way that we think about magic for these stories?
I absolutely think that we're losing something, and that's, for me at least, part of the story. The Institute has, they don't even call it magic, they call it the resource. Lark has this remembered conversation with her brother who went missing years ago, where he calls it magic, and she is shocked because you're not allowed to call it that. And he says, you know, that's what it is. They try to call it something else, but you should always call it what it is. And a lot of what happens in Skylark, and especially what happens in the next two books in the series, is the liberation of magic from this very strict and rigid framework that people have been using it in her city, the way people have been using it. And it's sort of she's sort of reclaiming magic as a wild, untamable thing throughout the series, which for me is important because it's very much for me the reclamation of childhood. The metaphor is that you stop believing in magic when you grow up. And I think that this story is about Lark discovering that magic is very much alive.
Oh, excellent. So in a sense, you've I am simply falling prey to the account of magic that Lark has been given by the Institute. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So there's been I wanted to take us in a little bit of a different direction.
Okay.
And we've mentioned how dark, you know, this is a book that I think, like many of the best young adult fantasy, is littered with both moments of beauty and moments of darkness. And as I've said, one of the things I like so much about it is that those are not radically separated in time and space. They're often at the same moment,
right.
Which I found very powerful. But there's been a lot of discussion lately. I mean, there was that, I'm sure everybody's talking about that New York Times thing or Wall Street Journal thing.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal, yeah.
Yeah, everybody's doing this now, right? About, yeah. Oh my God, young adult fantasy and science fiction, it's so dark and dystopian, and are we robbing children of their childhoods? And so, given the nature of this book, I think you've opened yourself up to being asked what you think about that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, and in a way, it's kind of throwing down my gauntlet, so I know I'm in for it. And the truth is that I could talk for hours about this topic. I'll try not to, but it is one that I feel very strongly about. I strongly believe that children's literature, and yes, young adult literature specifically, should not be censored or dumbed down or lightened up in any way. For one thing, I believe that children self-censor. I mean, I read Anne McCaffrey's Pern books when I was, I think, 8. And I don't mean her Harper Hall series for younger readers. I mean, like, the full Dragon Rider series. And those books are chock full of sex all over the place. But I had no idea. When I reread them as a teenager, I was just like, I do not remember this happening. Because when I was 8, I wasn't ready to read about sex, and I just skipped over it. I mean, I didn't know what was going on. It wasn't until I was older that I realized that I skipped over those parts. And, you know, I don't have children myself, so I'm not an expert. And I know that there are a lot of people out there who might argue with me. But I think it is undeniable that children are getting older faster with 24/7 access to media of all kinds, you know, TV, movies, the internet. And I think that the natural instinct is to want to try and shelter them and keep them young as long as possible. But, you know, there's the old argument that if they don't read about these topics in books, they're going to see them in movies, they're going to hear about sex, and they're going to hear language in school. You can't keep your kids in a bubble. And I think that books are important. I think dialogue is good. I think conversation is good. I think that parents shouldn't be frightened when their kids come to them with a question from something they read in a book. I think it's a gift. It lets you talk to them about the issues. It lets you educate them rather than leaving them to come into this adult world having to navigate it completely on their own.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I hear those complaints, and I think back to what I read in school in 7th and 8th grade, let alone I had the same experience as you did reading.
Yeah.
You know, you get sucked in by Dragon Song, Singer and Drums, and before you know it, you're reading books that are, you know, rather
way
more
over,
mature.
Yeah.
Your parents have no idea. So
My parents gave me those books. Mm-hmm. So my parents, I don't know if they forgot that there was sex in there or if they just didn't care. But, or if they knew that I wasn't going to read them. But, I mean, my father read science fiction when he was a child. You know, I come from a long line of readers, and my parents were just never the kind of parents to tell me I couldn't read something.
So, anyway, it's interesting. I'm now having this running dialogue with my wife about when to expose my 8-year-old daughter to different mm-hmm. works, and we've sort of got a line of things. But I think really it depends on. I mean, I think as a parent, what you learn is it depends on your kid.
Yeah.
So, you know, my daughter can handle some very mature stuff, but certain kinds of things set her off. But mm-hmm. But it is funny because I think back to the things I read in school as a 6th, 7th, and 8th grader, right? So
yeah.
Things like The Lottery and A Separate Piece. And these are not...
Lord of the Flies.
Yes, these are not exactly... light, shiny, happy works. So maybe there's a bit of hypocrisy or just attempts to generate a media storyline out of, you know, the Hunger Games or something going on there.
Well, if I can interrupt for just a second, I think the hypocrisy comes from literary versus commercial. I think when it's literature, and I'm using the same air quotes that you used earlier, when it's literature, it's okay. When it's commercial, it's trashy. And I think that there is a weird divide there that doesn't make a lot of sense, but definitely seems to exist anyway.
Well, I think those things are lazy shorthands for what really is a work-by-work determination, which is whether violence, sex, dark themes, not that sex is a dark theme, but things that we might think are on the edge of appropriateness for the age group, whether those things are deployed in a way that's thoughtful and has substance, or whether they're deployed for sort of cheap, cheap thrills. And I think that rather than ex ante say, this is literature, this is commercial, or this is genre work, and this is literary work. And if it's really genre work, it's become literary based on the powers that be. Decision has to be made based on the individual books and individual works. And a lot of the things that people are attacking now for being too dark, and I hope that Skylark is not attacked for being too dark, but I think I would put Skylark in this category, use that darkness to make certain arguments or to get their readers to think about moral ambiguity, to get their readers to think about, as you said, if they are going to have moments of great beauty and light, that also requires, a dark underside to it. So, but that anyway, people are here to listen to you, not to me. So, so that does naturally segue into one of the other questions I wanted to ask you, which is, what particular challenges and opportunities do you face right now being somebody who's writing young adult fiction?
Well, I think specifically with science fiction and fantasy, young adult fiction, world building actually ends up being a huge challenge. With adult literature, you get more room for explanation. Readers will stick with you longer, give you some breathing room, let you stop and explain the world you've created. With young adult, you have to jump into the story and stay in the story and keep it paced to within an inch of its life. You don't get to deviate for a chapter and give the reader a history of the world. You don't get to stop for a chapter and talk about Tom Bombadil. You have to balance the action with imparting nuggets of world building almost without anyone noticing. And I think that is probably one of the hardest things about when you're writing both young adult and science fiction fantasy, is you don't get to go off on these, flights of fancy. You have to stay very grounded. So that's definitely a challenge. But other than that, for me, it's not terribly a challenge to write young adult fiction. Young adult fiction is what I like to read. And for me, my memories of reading as a child, I was reading like a teenager. I was absolutely absorbed in the books that I was reading. I was completely transported. No one reads a book the way a child reads a book. And for me, that's the way I want people to read my books. I want them to pick them up and resurface 6 hours later and wonder where the time went. And so for me, there was never a question. I always wanted to write books for teens.
That's interesting. One of the things that I thought might pose a bit of an issue is that no matter how much we laud or talk about, kind of underestimating the capabilities of young adult readers or of children readers, one of the things that is true about children and young adults is that no matter how smart or voracious or willing to tackle difficult books they are, their capacity for abstract thought is all over the place. Mm-hmm. Right? And so one of the things that I would have thought would have presented the challenge is, how do you write a book that is capable of both entrancing the kids who are capable of thinking very abstractly at a young age, but also speaking to those kids or children who do not who have everything else but just haven't developed all of the abstract thinking capabilities such that they need things spelled out more for them than that first category would. Is that something that you consciously think about when you write this kind of work?
Well, I mentioned earlier that the themes tend to come in later, and I think that that plays a role here because ultimately when I start writing, I'm setting out to tell a good story. And that's all, really. I mean, that's my highest goal, is to tell a good story. And I think that there are some books out there that treat children's literature, and I'm including, when I say children's literature, I'm including YA literature, that treat children's literature as a platform to try to get kids thinking about certain issues. And I feel like that's got to be at least secondary to the story, if not, you know, way down the list of priorities. Because if you write a good story, kids are going to think about it. I mean, that's just the way it is. And you look at The Hunger Games, which is so popular right now. That's story, without any of its themes, just the story itself is riveting. I read that book in one sitting, and I don't normally do that anymore. I don't have the time to do that anymore. But I think that you can't help but think about it when you're addicted to a story. You can't help but go deeper. You can't help but want to spend time with it. You know, you're doing something else in your day and you start thinking about that book. And I think that in terms of appealing to a broad audience of both children who do tend toward introspection and those who don't, I think the key is layering. You have to have that good story there in place, and then you can add the other things. You can highlight the other things that come up as you're writing the story. But you have to make sure that the story functions on its own without those other aspects.
Well, you mentioned books that make you, that, you know, you dive into and you resurface and you wonder where the time went. And Skylark was definitely one of those books for me. I started it and, you know, too late at night and went to bed way too late. so I enjoyed it immensely. And I was wondering, what's next? I know that it sounds like this is the first book in a trilogy. Is that right?
Yes. The next book from me that will come out is Skylark's sequel, which is called Shadowlark. And that comes out of August next year. And then there will be a third book that comes out a year after that. But I also have another upcoming series that the first book comes out next year after Shadowlark. It comes out next year in November. And that the first in that series, it's a science fiction series, the first book called These Broken Stars. And they're both the start of trilogies. So that's, you know, counting Skylark, that's six books, which is a lot. You know, there was a period of time, I went from being a zero, nothing published ever writer to having six books sold in the span of 6 months. And, you know, the past couple years have been a long period of adjustment to that. I've never been contracted to write certain things before, so that's been a struggle. I know I said earlier that I tend to get distracted by the shiny new ideas very easily. And, you know, bringing myself down to focus on one thing, I think, has been really an intense learning experience for me. So that will be the next six books that come out, or five books after Skylark that come out. But I do have another project in the works. In my heart, I have a sort of wild affection for fairy tales and mythology classics. And there's a book that I've been working on for a few years in my spare time. You know, all that spare time that I have, that is a Beauty and the Beast retelling set in medieval Russia, blended with the fairy tale of Yvonne and the Firebird. It's sort of an interweaving of those two stories. And I'd love to see that, you know, tentatively for 2015, when Skylark is over and the last book of These Broken Stars will be coming out. But you know, that's so far ahead. And it's amazing how little time you have once the books start coming out. I had no idea. I kind of thought that authors were kind of being babies about how busy they were. I don't know. I thought they were exaggerating. But so I don't know. My wild fairy tale may have to stay the book of my heart for a little while longer.
Well, this sounds like a very exciting time for you, and I'm glad that despite how busy you are, you've agreed to come on with us and share your time with our listeners.
I had a lot of fun.
So thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And all the best.
Thanks.
Right, bye. This episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy was recorded August 16th, 2012, and featured Megan Spinner.